Okay, so it looks like everybody is with us. This is part of the Keystone Policy series of conference calls and webinars that's been developed by grantmakers of Western Pennsylvania and Philanthropy Network Greater Philadelphia. We're working to share with Pennsylvania funders how their colleagues are working on selected statewide policy issues, and this is the fourth in this series. Before we begin, I just wanted to cover a few housekeeping items. Yesterday, in advance of the call, I sent a one-pager with some resources to your email addresses. It includes bios of today's speakers, instructions for participating in the Q&A, and some additional resources and information about events related to this series that are coming up. During today's call, all of your lines, except for those speaking, will be muted to prevent interruptions and distractions. We do have time at the end of the call for questions, and during that time, you can click Raise Your Hand in the lower left part of your screen, and I'll identify the names of those hands raised. You'll have to unmute your line. Just do that by pressing star 7. And after asking a question, we just ask that you remute the line by pressing star 6. And you can also type in any questions to my attention at any time throughout the webinar. In the chat box that's also located in the lower left-hand side of the screen. Finally, I just want to let you know that the call is being recorded. The recording is available as a resource to just the members of Grantmakers of Western Pennsylvania and Philanthropy Network Greater Philadelphia, so you don't have to worry about it being broadly distributed. Today's session is focused on financially distressed municipalities. We're joined today by Jerry Cross, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Economy League, Max King, President and CEO of the Pittsburgh Foundation, and Karen Miller, Senior Fellow of the Berks County Community Foundation. So with that, I'm going to turn things over to Karen, who's going to start us off with some background information. Karen, you're on mute too, so you'll have to hit star 7 to unmute yourself to join us.
Thank you very much, Jenny, and hello to everybody. I'm sorry I sound like this. This is the first cold of spring, I think, but I hope we can get through without hacking too much. What I'd like to do is to start with a very short refresher course on Pennsylvania local government to put what Jerry and Max have to say into context. Pennsylvania is comprised of over 2,500 separately incorporated municipalities. We have multitudes of boroughs, two classes of townships, four classes of cities, and, lest we forget it, one town. The municipalities range in population from 11, that's 10 plus 1, to over 1.5 million, and a geographic size from less than one-tenth of a square mile, which is about a city block, to 157 square miles. Geographic size is no predictor of population size or government services. Every one of those over 2,500 municipalities, no matter what its size, has its own separate governing and revenue-raising body, often composed of part-time volunteers who are called on to make decisions, often expensive decisions, on difficult, complex issues. Municipalities are essentially children of the state. They exist because the state says they can. Each municipality must be run according to the rules of the road, that is, municipal codes and related laws set down by the state over the last 200 years. Rules that cover everything from contracting procedures with employee groups to enforcing state-established building and septic system standards to the kinds of taxes that can be imposed and how much can be collected. Except for the layering on of new mandates, municipal government has been for decades often ignored or treated with indifference by the state's governing body until things go really wrong. By the 1980s, things were obviously going really wrong in western Pennsylvania as a result of the collapse of the steel industry. So in 1987, the state legislature enacted the Financially Distressed Municipalities Act, better known as Act 47. The purpose of the act was to temporarily give down and out municipalities management help and increase taxation powers to help them get back on their feet. Well, the advice on how to improve management usually worked, but the envisioned growth in local economic strength usually didn't happen. And Act 47 became a last-ditch survival tool for municipalities across the state as the effects of global economic changes and demographic shifts outstripped the ability of municipalities to adjust service levels and revenues under the existing municipal codes and mandates. For reasons of local pride as well as strict criteria for admission, Act 47 has never been entered into lightly. 10 years ago, a Pennsylvania Economy League analysis warned that a growing number of municipalities throughout the Commonwealth, not just cities, were heading for fiscal distress as a consequence of state laws that mandate out-of-date and often expensive rules of the road, fail to offer compelling incentives for municipalities to work together as a way to increase efficiency and save money, and provide local governments with revenue streams that are largely inelastic, capped, and out of sync with budget needs. PEL urged the Commonwealth to fix the system or face continued fiscal decline that is often inevitable given the rules under which municipalities with even the best financial management system must operate. Little has been done by the state since that call for systemic change. The result, a new PEL analysis, now in the last stages of preparation, shows that further erosion of central key measures of fiscal health that signal a community's ability to pay for critical services at a level that citizens can afford. Adding to the seriousness and immediacy of the current findings are recent amendments to the state's Act 47 legislation that include a strict timetable for how long municipalities can remain in the distressed municipality program. The deadlines were imposed because many of these communities have lingered in Act 47 for years, some for decades. Act 47's provision have kept these municipalities afloat, but not fixed their situation to the point that the municipalities can graduate from the program. When does the time run out for these municipalities? Some as early as this year, and certainly over the next 3 years. Clearly, municipalities of all types, even relatively healthy ones, struggle under the current local government system. Of most immediate concern, what will happen to those Act 47 municipalities when they are returned to the system that failed them in the first place? What will happen to the community perception and financial picture of Pennsylvania as a whole should significant population and commercial centers go into receivership? And finally, what should be philanthropy's role in getting the public and Pennsylvania state government to address these issues? And I'll turn things over to Jerry. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. Did I unmute myself correctly there, Jenny?
You did. We can hear you.
Okay, thank you. I'm glad you could hear us. With me today is Lynn Shedlock, one of the main report writers and researchers. But Karen, building on Karen's comments, yes, the 2006 Economy League report showed that growing number of municipalities were becoming distressed. And that information was from the 70s through the early 2000s, 2003. And as Karen indicated, little has changed since then, despite calls for reform. That report in 2006 highlighted the fact that inflexible state rules on revenues and expenditures had constricted municipalities' ability to continue to operate. The revenue streams, that is the taxes and fees, really weren't able to grow with increased expenses over time. They're capped. and the law is out of sync with the budget needs, the laws that they operate under. The report also showed that there was really no compelling incentives for municipalities to work together to increase efficiency or save money. State laws really make it hard to work together in a meaningful way. The report concluded that because of these restrictions, there's a natural life cycle that causes municipal distress, and like any life cycle, it reflects the environment, it reflects the nature of the organisms in it, and that report had an innovative listing of the stages of decline, as we called it, for municipal distress, and I think the current report built to that idea and also reinforced it. We also thought in the 2006 report that the systemic problem of local government was not a result of the local incompetence of elected leaders, as much as we like to think that. There's not a willingness or a lack of willingness to improve the situation of local government. There's an inability to do it. And oftentimes, faced with increasing taxes or cutting services, the systemic solution by local governments over the last 40 years has been to reduce services and defer maintenance and defer improvements to infrastructure. We see the fruits of that now. We're reaping those results. Anytime you go anywhere in Pennsylvania that hasn't that has older infrastructure, older roads, older services. And oftentimes, municipalities simply levied fees to charge for services that were once provided free of charge in the sense that the tax base under any other taxes provided them. A good example is garbage collection that perhaps 40-some years ago in cities was once and twice a week and covered by tax dollars, and it's currently now almost universally provided by fees or private haulers working under contract. Needless to say, the taxes did not go down. We're also sorry to report that the new report that will be released shows that there's been increasing fiscal delay from 1990 to 2014 for all municipalities in Pennsylvania. As Karen pointed out, there are 2,500-plus municipalities. The data in the report covers about 2,400 of them because of inconsistencies and such. So the report, we think, is a good indicator, and the conclusions are solid based on the financial information that we analyze from municipalities. If you'll bear with me with a brief technical description of the report's methodology so you can understand some of the things we say. The report measured the tax base per household that municipalities have to work with. It's important to know on tax base that Philadelphia and Pittsburgh are not included in the listing of municipalities because they perversely or not operate under a whole different set of tax laws and revenue laws, so it makes them very difficult to compare those. Plus, their numbers dwarf most of the other municipalities, so we remove them from the burden. But they're not immune to the crisis, as anyone that follows the local government financial news realizes. But we measure tax base per household, which we like to call the municipal purse. In other words, how much wealth is there to tax? And the tax burden, that's how much money comes out of that wealth. How much does the municipality reach into its tax purse to pay for services? And obviously there's a point in time where those two conflict and citizens say, wait a minute, you're taxing me too hard. Some of the indicators that we'll show in another graphic is that when you look at increasing the tax base, that's a positive outcome. You know, the local wealth is increased. When you look at increasing tax burden, as measured by our percentages, that obviously is a negative. There's more money leaving local households for local government services in support of local government operations. One of the findings is tax burden has actually increased. The negative indicator of tax burden has increased on average for all types of municipalities since 1990. And Jenny, there's a graphic, if you have that graphic, to show the bar graph. Tax base has declined on average for cities for the last 24 years, but increased for boroughs and second-class townships. It's on the screen now. If you can look at that graphic, that bar graph, I'll run it through real quick. As bars go to the right, that's bad, and as bars go to the left, that's good, but don't worry about it. There's none going to the left. But if you look at the first two bars, those are the two cities, the third-class cities, and Scranton City, which is called the city of the second class A. Notice those bars are relatively short, which that means is the burden. This graph demonstrates changes in tax burden. And remember, the greater your tax burden changes, the more negative indicator that is. If you notice that the cities haven't relatively grown that much compared to the other ones, 16% and 17%, I like to think that shows the extent of the damage that occurred in cities, in tax bases, from 1970 to 1990. There was already a lessening of the tax base in cities as incomes fled and people fled the cities for suburban developments and as the populations changed in the cities. So while that's not as dramatic a finding, the borough bar is, as well as the townships in particular. The boroughs have outpaced the cities in their decline from tax base. They've gotten poorer since 1990. That's a reversal of a trend we saw from 70 to 90. So boroughs are not immune. Boroughs are small cities. If you're familiar with the concept, they're essentially urban centers that are defined oftentimes by railroad junctions and some navigation, some water navigation. But boroughs, on the whole, have lost taxability and their tax burdens increased. Townships are the first class. The next bar is probably the biggest surprise in the report from a point of view of change. Townships of the first class are typically those next to cities. A lot of people call them the outer ring municipalities. The first class townships exist around nearly every city of significant size. There's reasons for that. There's legislative reasons for that, historical reasons. But look at how much the tax burden has had to increase to maintain the level of expenditures or services or whatever you want to define for the municipality in first-class townships. That tells us that wealth has been diminished in first-class townships. That tells us that the purse has gotten smaller or not grown accordingly. Therefore, the amount of money taken out by the government had to increase. Second-class townships, which has been, as everyone knows, second-class townships are probably the success story of the last 40 years in local governments. Starting in the late 60s, early 70s, there was an outward migration from urban areas to second-class townships with the consequential redevelopment of farmland. The open space movement was farmlands was heavily developed. You had a lot of wealth moving into townships with very little action by the townships themselves. They oftentimes roads and sewers were extended, and the availability of land was there. That increased the wealth for municipalities. That trend really stayed in place through the 90s. However, our report starts to show that townships of the second class, those that kind of had really good salad days since 1970, are starting to see upward pressure. And people that moved out of the cities and boroughs to avoid taxes to second-class townships in their subdivisions and their newer developments are now going to see increasing demands for services, and they're going to see increasing burdens on the tax base. That's an interesting concept because that ties everything together, that all municipalities are in the same life cycle. It's just a matter of how far along you are. Just as a younger person is likely to be more stronger and more healthier than an older person, inevitably, with luck, the younger person gets older and suffers all the same symptoms of old age. And I think we're seeing that in some of the municipalities. Additionally, for Act 47 municipalities, they perform poorly on the measurements uniformly. When we compare the Act 47 municipalities with the regular municipalities, there was no difference. The 47 municipalities were much worse off. They performed more poorly, and that's despite years of oftentimes in the program, decades in the Act 47 program with state assistance and exceptions to the rules. We have another graphic, and that indicates the level of services provided. And the level of services provided is a good indicator, we think, as a symptom of financial distress because the service provided is relative to the ability to pay for it or to defer or certain things to pay for other things. And we think that the ability to pay for that is a good symptom. One of the highest portions of a municipal budget is police services. We do a lot of work in local governments on in the economy league. Uniformly, if you have a police department, you can expect that to be 30 to 50% of your budget. It's not unusual at all for 40% of a budget to go to police services. Oftentimes, if you don't have a police department and you add one, you're talking of an expense of $100,000 or more per policeman added. Rule of thumb is you need at least five policemen to be able to say you have a full-time police force that is around-the-clock coverage. So you could see that decision simply adds $500,000 immediately to a town's budget and ability to pay for that. So we think that's a good example of the broken system that, in our case, provides financial inequality between those who pay for local police and those who get free state police access. You've seen, no doubt, in the news lately the debate about free police coverage. I know some of our op-eds that were distributed talked about it. This map will show you that there's a large part of Pennsylvania that is not covered by local police, that's covered by state police. I'm sure you can recognize your county in there. The blue area is where people have reported actually having police departments or providing police through service contracts. And when we looked at our measures in the report, it was clear that municipalities that pay for their own police coverage on average, they do worse in the measurements than those that get free police coverage. State police have to cover your town if you don't have police departments. So you see there's an incentive not to create a police department, that is not to provide more services, and there's a disincentive to those that provide police services because of the budget impact, and they have to spend more money or defer expenditures on other things other than police items. Why this is kind of interesting for statewide is that one of the ways the state police has been being paid for by this extra work they have to do is they're using tax dollars designed for other things. In other words, the state is providing services in replacement of other things that benefit everyone else to provide local government services that are lacking. The motor license fund was been earmarked when the tax was raised, was earmarked for roads and bridges. And that has been increasingly used to pay for state police coverage from the 2013 gas tax increase. The Commonwealth General Fund provides about a quarter of the expense of the state police. That's roughly $250 million. But the motor license fund, the gas tax, which was designed to repair what we drive on with our cars, brings in about $800 million to the motor license fund, another three quarters. I got those numbers right, Liz?
$800 million for the state police
budget. There you go. I got a funny look from Lynn. I said, oh, I just stated that one. But the state police budget comes from the $800 million for the motor license fund. Those numbers are staggering, and I stagger over them all the time. The cost to state police for the municipal coverage is estimated at $600 million, just to cover the 92% of rural municipalities, and more troublesome, the 22% of urban municipalities that don't have police departments. And urban, I mean really urban. We're talking municipalities, 10, 15, 20, 30,000 people that do not have police coverage. The governor, to respond to something like this, the governor has proposed a $25 per capita fee for those places that use state police. But that really is beside the question. The question is not whether to have police, but who pays for it. There are large, wealthy municipalities that use the state police. We think this is cost avoidance on their part, and it's an example of the disincentives we find in municipal financial system. Obviously, if one can avoid a big cost, the system makes an incentive to do so and offload the cost to others, being all other Pennsylvanians. There's another graphic that explains what we would have called the life cycle in the other report, but this one gives you an idea how we rank the municipalities. When we were trying to compare 2,500 municipalities with themselves and with all others, we used the quintile system. We essentially ranked everyone by the tax base, tax burden scores. We scored them. We ranked them. We split them into five portions, quintiles, so that we could say that if you're in the first quintile, you're better than 80% of the municipalities that were ranked. And if obviously you're in the bottom quintile, you're worse than 80% of the municipalities. The graphic is interesting because the graphic ties together our report from 10 years ago with the current quintile rankings. Those that are in the top 20% of the state, we can comfortably say they have prosperity with low taxes. And that number perhaps is not as big as it was 40 years ago. It's still 20%, but it's not the width of wealth within that quintile may not be as wide. The second quintile, that's when you have increasing demand for services. People have moved to your town. Population has increased, and you have to raise taxes to provide that service because your easy money is starting to slow down. When easy money slows down, you start to look at reductions to non-core services. And non-core services are those things that perhaps they were amenities at the town. It was parks. Perhaps it's expansion of sewer systems. Perhaps it's things that are nice to have in your town, and they separate your town from others, and they're just distinguishing characteristic, but they're not core. They don't keep cops on the beat. They don't enforce the code enforcement. They don't make sure that sewers are doing their job. When you move further down the scale in the quintile rankings, the municipalities in those groups exhibit reductions in core services as a common theme. They start to have deficits. They start to have higher tax rates. They start to realize that they can't continue the level of expenditures and services they have, and they start to remove core services. It's not uncommon for roads to be unrepaired, for municipal buildings to have leaky roofs, sidewalks to be in states of disrepair, potholes that last much longer. And that has an effect on citizens. It has an effect on property values, and that leads you to the last quintile where you start to lose your tax base and you start to enter into fiscal distress. Now, Act 47 municipalities, we like to think they're the leading edge of this spear, but honestly, Act 47 municipalities have not been able to break out of the cycle, not been able to break out of the systemic problems that we see. One of the problems that we see coming up with Act 47 towns and other towns that are in the fifth quintile is that larger tax rates aren't going to work. Expenditure controls aren't effective. And you're going to see a lot of asset sales. You're going to see a lot of municipalities deleveraging their sewer systems, their water systems. We see it a lot now. It's one of the larger areas of growth that we see in municipal work. How much is my water system worth? How much is my sewer system worth? What can I leverage? How can I sell this? What's my parks worth? If I have a golf course, I'm selling it. Those kind of things, which were permanent amenities, become now disposable assets to keep pace. The states failed to address those core issues, so the municipalities that are in Act 47, they had to stay there to remain viable. The system provided a safe harbor. That system no longer provides a safe harbor. It now has a deadline for exiting. We think that the problems of poverty and blight and other factors are going to continue to exist regardless of what deadlines the legislature makes. The mismatch of revenues and expenditure is not going to be cured by legislative fiat or demanding that someone gets better. One of the coordinators, the Act 47 coordinators, state-appointed people that helped the municipality, said to us, the Act 47 situation now is like the legislature telling a sick person they have 6 months to get better, but then ignoring them and not giving them any extra medicine. I'll see you in 6 months, God willing. So the statewide implications of what we're talking about in this report is they're dire regardless of where you live, work, or shop. Through the contagion of crime and blight and poverty from lower wealthy municipalities, service declines, infrastructure deterioration. But I think it says best that once we damage the reputation of a state, if you think of Detroit or the Ohio River that was on fire 40-some years ago, people tend to remember the bad things about your state, and businesses may or may not relocate there because of perceived impressions. If our municipalities aren't seen as livable spaces and we have a failure to provide for public safety and welfare, people won't want to relocate here or come here. And I'll finish by quoting from the report, so bear with me while I read you something. But this comes directly from the report, and I think it cues up well for Max. The question is, why should we care? Because quality of life is one of the most important factors in decisions ranging from where to locate a business to whether our children choose to remain in Pennsylvania as adults. The quality of life is based on what people see in their communities, whether the streets are well-maintained and not full of potholes, whether neighboring homes are well-kept or are victims of blight, whether people feel safe in their towns or are wary of burgeoning crime, whether police services or public services are sufficient and reasonably priced. Therefore, the ability of municipalities to deliver the basic functions that result in a good quality of life is crucial to the economic sustainability and vitality of the Commonwealth as a whole. The growing incidence of municipal financial distress, with its resulting decline in the ability of local governments to deliver services necessary for good quality of life, will have and has had a chilling effect on the ability of the state to present itself as a healthy community that can attract and keep businesses and residents. Thank you, Jenny. Now I think Max has...
Thank you, Jerry. So, Max, can I turn it over to you to talk to us a little bit about philanthropy's role? And, Karen, feel free to jump in as well.
Thanks, Jenny. Am I unmuted?
You are. We can hear you loud and clear.
Great. Great. Well, there's a couple of things that I think are particularly distressing right now and should be attended to by philanthropy. I think there are things that, you know, philanthropy in Pennsylvania is by and large a community building exercise, not just the community foundations, but all of the foundations in this state work very hard to build the communities with which they're associated. So I think that there's very important stuff in this report for us to pay careful attention to. But there's a couple of things that are particularly distressing to me. One is that with this ramp, this exit ramp that's been created by the legislature now for the 18 communities that are in Act 47 over a five-year period of time, we're going to start seeing very soon in the next couple of years a string of communities coming out of Act 47, unprepared to come out of Act 47, without their fiscal and financial situation improved in a significant way. And so I think there's a very good chance we're going to see a string of bankruptcies. These are going to be communities that will come out of, will be forced out of Act 47, and will have probably very little choice except to go bankrupt. And so we're going to have sort of a big marketing program over the next 10 years in Pennsylvania, in which we advertise to the nation that we have a string of failing cities, and that our cities and municipalities and towns in Pennsylvania are doing really, really poorly. So I think it's something we need to pay attention to, whether those communities in Act 47 are in our region or not. Scenario that's been set up by the action of the legislature is going to create a very poor situation for any hope of extended economic development for the state, bringing companies here, bringing young people here, bringing jobs here. That's one of the things that's distressing to me. I don't think the legislature thought through the implications of setting up the exit ramp, as Jerry said. We're forcing these communities out without any particular help for them. And if they fail, that failure is going to characterize the whole state of Pennsylvania. The second thing that I find very worrisome and distressing is that this report clearly shows that the legislature and state government in this state pays no attention to the needs of municipalities. In fact, has created laws, regulations, tax code, controls on taxes and fees that are extremely harmful to municipalities and by and large has created this situation. And this comes at a time when people all over the world, and particularly in the United States, are choosing to live in cities and towns. There's a huge trend, macro trend in this country and around the entire world, in which people are beginning to move toward cities, towns, and metropolitan areas and leave rural areas. 100 years ago, well over 80% of the American population lived in rural areas. Today, well over 80% of the American population lives in metropolitan areas, in cities, towns, large cities, small cities. And in the world, for the first time in the history of the world now, over 50% of the population of the world is living in metropolitan areas or in municipalities. So there's a really important worldwide trend of people, companies, activity, particularly young people, wanting to be in these municipal areas. And they don't all want to be in the biggest cities. They're not flocking as much to New York or Los Angeles. Frankly, they're flocking to places like Pittsburgh, which is doing much better than it was 10, 15, 20 years ago, because companies and young people want to be in a mid-sized city that has a lot of the amenities that they're looking for, has a lot of the quality of life that they're looking for. But just at the time that there is this trend in the world of people choosing to want to be in municipal areas because of everything that is offered, the culture, the architecture, the education facilities that are in municipal areas, just at a time when this is the trend in the United States and globally, Pennsylvania's the official governing bodies of Pennsylvania, the House, the Senate, and to some extent the governor's office, are turning their back on municipalities. They've created a situation that is dire for municipalities in terms of revenue, in terms of managing resources, and they're paying no attention, and they're refusing to pay attention. I think you find the legislature completely wrapped up in their own tax and budget issues, the state budget and state tax issues in Harrisburg. And when municipalities try to get attention from the legislature, they're usually unsuccessful. So we have a very untenable situation for municipalities, for almost all the cities in Pennsylvania, at exactly at a time when we should be using them as resources. If you drive around Pennsylvania and you drive into cities, large cities, mid-sized cities, smaller cities, towns, you'll see that Pennsylvania is studded with an array of really, really very pretty, attractive old cities and towns. A lot of them are deteriorating now, but they've got great history, great architecture, at a time when we could be using those communities to build on them. They are, even the ones that are not anywhere near Act 47, are in some financial distress. And until the legislature takes this issue seriously, how the cities function financially, how they're funded from a tax standpoint, it's not going to get any better. And we're going to lose the opportunity to use these communities, these municipalities, as a way of attracting young people, attracting companies, attracting jobs. And I think what the legislature is simply turned its back on the municipalities, is ignorant of how bad the problem is, and I'm really not sure exactly how we get their attention. But it's a great concern, I think, and should be a great concern for philanthropy. Karen, do you or Jerry want to jump in at that point?
Well, I think you did an excellent job of laying out the issues, Max. I think maybe we'll just turn it over and see if people have any questions or any observations.
Sure. Let's see. Feel free to raise your hand if you have any questions. Fred, I see your hand. If you want to unmute by hitting *7 and ask your question.
Okay, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you, Fred. Go ahead.
So I guess my question, I'm certainly not going to defend the legislature, and I agree with everything everybody said about abandoning municipalities, but playing devil's advocate for a second, some might argue that this off-ramp for Act 47 provides the first opportunity for distressed municipalities in Pennsylvania to disincorporate, which, right now there's really no option but to go bankrupt. And while on the one hand this may be driving people towards bankruptcy, my recollection is there's provisions in the Act that would allow an option to bankruptcy, namely disincorporation. So I'm wondering if any of the speakers can address whether or not that's pie in the sky or whether it may be a foot in the door of giving more opportunity to merge or whatnot?
Well, this is Karen Miller. I think that the question is disincorporate and go where? Every single square inch of Pennsylvania is incorporated. There is, and Jerry, I think, probably has a better handle on the legalisms of this, but who would take them in? When I was secretary at the beginning days of Act 47, I was trying to get municipalities to take each other in, and they wouldn't do it. So I'm not at all sure who, if, say, I'll take my city.
Well,
city if, in case my city of Reading disincorporated, who would, where would it go? Who would provide the services?
So I guess I would respond to that by saying I realize the bigger the city, the more complicated it becomes. But for smaller municipalities, I think one of the leading arguments would be you default into the county and that the county can gain economies of scale. Again, that may be pie in the sky, but that seems to be the silver lining I hear on occasion.
But, Fred, if a community the size of Aliquippa or Clairton or Braddock disincorporated, they would become what, then part of the county government?
Yes. And, again, I'm not arguing this as a good thing, but I'm saying I think counties, in most other states, counties are sort of the, many times the lowest, the common denominator form of government, and our bizarre proliferation of municipalities is not anything to be proud of. I think, 20% or more of less than 500 people or something?
Oh, well, probably 70 or 80%.
I think if the state wanted to go to a county by county system, it could be done in a much more effective manner than letting municipalities fail and disincorporate as the means to going to a county system. And I think one of the things that we see in even municipalities that are mid-size, and certainly in the larger ones, is that they have a tremendous amount of nonprofit property in the community, and they can't get tax revenue from that nonprofit property. I think Pittsburgh is over 40% nonprofit, and there have been appeals to the legislature to no avail to find some relief from that. There's also the question for mid-sized to larger-sized municipalities of being able to provide some sort of reasonably structured tax system for commuters who come into the city to work and use the city but don't live there. Things like that have just gotten no hearing at all from the legislature.
Okay, thank you. I did not intend to defend the legislature. I just wanted to get a better sense of those exit provisions, so to say.
I think you do put one very good point on the table, though, Fred, which is there are a lot of other states that have not relied on this sort of proliferation of municipalities, but instead put much more of the authority into the hands of county governments.
Max, this is Jerry. To answer Fred's question, I think it seems simple the way he posed it, and it makes sense. Of course, that never got through the legislature. The disincorporation procedures under the law now for municipalities prohibit towns that have police departments from being disincorporated. And secondly, as Karen mentioned, where do they go? They go kind of to purgatory or limbo, I guess. They go to the state. And the state then charges a service fee to the municipal residents. They no longer pay taxes. They will now pay a service fee to get the services that was provided to them prior. So, and the counties in Pennsylvania, while those of us that look at other states in that form recognize the county form of government as maybe the federal government recognizes that usually as the smallest workable level of local government. In Pennsylvania, counties don't have powers like municipalities. They don't even have police powers. The sheriff's department is responsible for prisoners and courthouse security. So there's a real disconnect, like we always see in Pennsylvania, between what local governments think they can provide or what their citizens want them to provide and what the law lets them provide. And I think you said bizarre. I think I agree with that.
Hello?
Hi. Is this John?
No, this is Nick.
Oh, I'm okay. Go ahead, Nick.
One thought I had with the antiquated property tax system in this state, if you look across, especially in rural areas, you'll find a lot of very old homes. I used to live in one, and I put several thousand dollars of repair into it to save it from falling down, and the taxes never went up. It was still on the books because of the footprint rules and everything. The last time our county reassessed was in the 70s. In order to, there's got to be a way to unlock the value of the older homes and take the burden off the people that are building new homes and paying taxes on essentially the entire market value of the new properties versus the locked-up value in the old one, at least to spread the tax base out uniformly.
Hi, this is John Dawes.
Any response to that?
Well, I think that everybody would agree that the property tax system in Pennsylvania is leaves a lot to be desired. The difficulty is, of course, that the counties are supposed to reassess but don't want to reassess, don't have to reassess, and certainly don't want to because then people will get mad at them because there will inevitably be some people whose properties will be assessed higher, and that is never popular.
One idea that I think might it'd be a hard sell, but one thing that would take the some of the argument out of there for uniformity, use what the properties are insured for. Nobody underinsures their house. So find some way to work in a formula the percentages, what the house is insured for. That's the value of it. And get away from the 1970s reassessment and everything. Everybody insures their property against loss, so use that as the basis for taxation.
So I see a couple more hands raised here. John Dawes, do you want to go ahead, and then Jerry, we'll get to you.
Sure. Can you hear me? Am I unmuted?
Yes, you are.
Yes.
Okay, good. I just want to thank all the presenters. This was really excellent in terms of getting a vision around trends. I concur with Max's thinking about young people moving to urban areas. It is a huge trend. The Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds provides grants to small towns and hard-hit areas, a lot of coalfield communities, in order to access agency funding. And I just wanted to throw out the idea of an opportunity, which is amazingly happening right now in our House and Senate, and that is to release $1 billion from the Abandoned Mine Lands Fund in Washington, D.C., Department of Interior. And a bicameral initiative has taken place through Hal Rogers' office, H.R. 1731, our Matt Cartwright from Pennsylvania, co-sponsor. The same bill was introduced in the Senate, S. 728, by McConnell. And, certainly, if anything's going to happen with the new world order in Washington, D.C., it's going to be done by leadership of those parties. It's an unprecedented opportunity to deal with property values and scars and pollution affecting human health and quality of life in those poor municipalities. And if anyone would like for me to send it around, we did a paper on what this legislation would do to towns like Ehrenfeld. We used that as an example and funded a project which resulted in a $22 million grant from the Office of Surface Mining and the launch of a restoration project removing a spoil pile, which is going to provide increased value to that municipality. The mayor came to our opening, as did Sally Jewell from Department of Interior, the secretary, and the mayor wept because he felt like he could resell his house, which he had lost that vision. He thought he would live there until he died, but because of improvements. And it's an opportunity that we just don't want to miss. And it's called the Reclaim Act. It's a big, long acronym for revitalizing communities around abandoned mines, that type of thing. So just wanted to throw it out there and make you, the leaders, understand how valuable it is to Pennsylvania. Also, ARC funding is proposals around ARC are attached to Reclaim, and it's important for the reason that it's a resource, and currently our governor is national co-chair. So.
Thank you, John.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry, did you have something to add?
Yeah, I wasn't sure if I was unmuted when I was trying to answer Fred's question.
I'm not sure.
Okay, but it doesn't matter now. But I think there is a lot of the question that Fred had posed about the disincorporation and Karen's response and Max's response. I think a lot of that reflects the problems with the financial laws we operate under for Pennsylvania.
Yes.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if I was
yes,
pushing.
Yes, that's good.
Okay, thanks.
Are there any other questions?
When does the PEL report come out?
That's one of the issues that we're going to be discussing at the foundation meeting on at the end of this month in Camp Hill, for a minute, I forgot entirely where it was. But because, as you know, it's a heck of a lot easier to get people to pay attention to issues that are already moving than issues that where you have to start from scratch. And the two issues that are already moving are obviously the Act 47 communities. And the other one is whether or not we can remove some of the inequities for inherent in state government by talking about the state police funding. And that report, that part of the report, will be released quite soon, I think.
I definitely want to get a copy when they are.
And I would say, as one of the funders of the PEL report, the Pittsburgh Foundation would hope it would come out as soon as possible.
We'll also be interested in hearing your ideas how the philanthropic community could help us get the message out.
And Karen, we can do some of that with our follow-up message after this. After this call, we can see if we can collect any information for you.
Thank you.
If there are no other questions, we can go ahead and wrap up. We're just a few minutes ahead of time. Did I hear another question? Okay. Well, I guess we'll go ahead and wrap up then. Thank you so much to Jerry and Max and Karen for joining us and for sharing your knowledge and insights on this. And thank you to everyone for logging on and joining us for this. Like I said, you'll receive a follow-up email from me. We'll have links to the recording, the recorded webinar, some of the visuals that Jerry shared with us, and some other supporting materials. So if you haven't already, I also wanted to mention quickly a couple upcoming opportunities to stay engaged. Our next Keystone Policy Series is coming up right away next week. We don't usually have them in such short order, but this one came onto our radar and we wanted it available next Thursday from 2 to 3 o'clock, combating Pennsylvania's opioid epidemic. So that will be coming up next week. And then don't forget to register for the 2017 Pennsylvania Foundation Public Policy Conference. This one is in person, not just over the phone. You'll have an opportunity to meet with your colleagues on May 1st and 2nd in Harrisburg. The links for both of those items will be in the follow-up email as well. So thanks to everyone, and have a great week.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you very much.